بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. Peace and love on Brother Ali. This is the Travelers Podcast. This is a video episode. We've got over 70 episodes of this podcast. Some of them have been all video. Some are only audio. So if you're listening to this one in audio format, you should know that there's video. And I'm really glad that there is, because the place that we recorded it, it's important to see it and to get a sense of the place as well as the person. The guest on this podcast, this episode, is ANT, Anthony Davis, who's the producer for Atmosphere. He also produced most of the music that people know me for. And he's an extremely important and special and unique human being. And part of why it was so important to talk to him in his basement is because he's not somebody that does a lot of interviews. He doesn't talk a lot. He prefers to be behind the scenes and to really speak with the music that is made. And so much of it really emanates, and it starts from this room full of records that serve as the inspiration and the references and the talking points and the jumping off points for the conversations that happen between people, but also the connection that happens between him and the artist that he works with. And the way that hearts come together, that people see each other, respond to each other, validate each other, work with each other and heal each other, to be able to bring out all of the beauty that's inside of the people, the artists that are working together. It's a real genuine collaboration. And in our culture and in our society, there's less and less of that. So that alone makes it really special. And you hear it in the Atmosphere music. You hear it in the music that I've made with him, and the music that he's made with Musab and Dem Atlas and Iself Divine and The Grouch and so many other people that he's worked with. It's very, very special. I'm recording this in Istanbul, Turkey, in my studio here. This is where my family's lived for the last couple years. And it is like, do the right thing, hot outside, and my AC is broken. So I'm remembering being back in Minneapolis and recording this in a nice, cool basement, you know what I'm saying, in the spring in Minneapolis. This podcast, like I said, we have over 70 episodes. We talked to Chuck D, we talked to Pharoah Monch and Immortal Technique and Ilhan Omar and Cornel West and all types of really, really incredible people from different walks of life. And it's a beautiful thing. This is really sponsored in two ways. The first of which is called The Caravan. So if you go to brotherali.com in the join section, there's a community there. And that's really the way that we built our musical careers, not based on the music industry, not based on media platforms. Those things didn't exist when we started. We really did this by connecting with the people that it speaks to, dealing directly with the people that our art and what comes out of us finds its home inside of your heart. And the connection is very deep, and you're the people that we care about. And so we're not real big on sponsorships. We're not real big on advertising. But if you go to brotherali.com in the join section, you'll see there's a whole community there. People have access to all sorts of conversations and connections, and also rare and exclusive music and videos and podcast episodes and all type of stuff that you can't get anywhere else. Also, we do have a partnership with a group called the Zakat Foundation, which is a global humanitarian organization. They do really dope work all over the world. They're genuine, sincere people. It's not some corporate BS. It's really very, very special. So if you go to Zakat, ZAKAT.org, that's their website, or go to Zakat US on social media, check out what they're doing. As you listen to this, go and get down on one of those two things. Either join the caravan or put something in Zakat Foundation or both. But either way, we're very grateful that you're here. We love and appreciate you. And please enjoy this very, very special episode with my man. And one thing I want to say, there are people that listen to this podcast with their kids. One of the communities that I come from is a very spiritual, religious community. So usually when people are talking, if somebody happens to use some language that might be offensive to certain people, we'll mute it. Like, we don't edit them. We don't tell them what to say or not say. But usually if it comes up, we just mute it so that people listening with their kids, it's not a problem. You'll find that Anthony speaks in such a unique way that's so special that we just left it completely alone. So you're going to hear some of that kind of filth, flaw, and filth in this episode. But the reality is that we just wanted to really get a very, very special and unique opportunity to hear and see and learn and experience this really beautiful man. My man, Ant, enjoy this episode of the Travelers Podcast. You don't do a lot of interviews.
No, I don't. But I've done a few lately, and I've done a few in the past.
I was trying to figure out, like, because there's that one that we did with James Everest.
Yes.
In the hole, in like 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool.
Yes, I was, I remember being happy with that to some degree. But it was very strange. It was in front of an audience.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I was playing more of a character than normal, or was I really being real? I don't know. I don't know if I'm doing that now either.
Yeah.
You know, when the camera's on, it's just like there's a part of you that just becomes not authentic for me and for most people I know.
Yeah.
It's just naturally, you just start, I'm going to be a character of me or the best version of me. Or something.
Right.
It's like a first date.
It would almost be fake to act like you don't know that there's a camera on though too.
Yeah.
Because like anytime you're talking to a person and it's just the two of you, that's all you have to consider. Mm. You know what I mean? So like when I'm talking to a person, me and them, I'm trying to just cater to them.
Yes.
But then once I know that other people are going to see this, then I start thinking about all those people and their feelings.
Mm.
And also like them judging me and judging this other person.
Yeah.
So it's like to pretend that that's not there that would be fake too.
Yeah. So thanks for understanding my situation.
Yeah.
No, I figured you were similar. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm saying, like, and you know it. You actually told me like when we first started doing the podcast, you're like, man, you might be more yourself if you didn't do the video part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I couldn't tell if that was like, because I know you and I'm watching you, you know, I can't tell sometimes. It's kind of like any of my friends that I know pretty good and I see him on camera, I'm like, man, that ain't how that motherfucker is. He ain't like that.
Yeah.
But the hot seat's the hot seat. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's really like no...
There's no way around it.
Not really. I have noticed that there are certain people though, like some really, really dope interviewers. Like I've been really watching interviewers, like especially since I've been doing this.
Yeah.
But my grandfather was a journalist. Like he interviewed people.
Oh, dude. I didn't even realize that.
He did that almost like instead
of... I knew he was a writer, but...
Yeah. But he would like... That's what he did with people in general, is like he would interview even like people in the family.
Okay.
And so like it would make you feel really important. And like he was like... he would just ask a million questions and stuff. But I started noticing that one of the things that some people are really good at is like they make the other person feel comfortable right away. Mm. And that's like such a big key of it. It's not even like what the interviewer is saying or the questions they're asking.
Yeah.
But like if they're comfortable, then they make the other person instantly comfortable.
Yeah. Well, that's a gift too, if you can do that.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to figure that out over time, like really how to do that better.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll get there.
And then I think about too, also like you as a producer, like you in a way, it's a really similar thing like to being an interviewer.
Mm.
Because as an interviewer, like I'm trying to create a situation where people can see you the way I see you.
Oh yeah.
And that's what you're doing producing for people, is like, you know, especially the people that you work with and the type of producer you are, you know who we are and you see us in ways that we don't always see ourselves. And then you're trying to create the music that'll bring that out and the mood that'll bring that out. And also the vibe in the studio that'll try to make us write like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, it's a similar thing, it seems like.
Trying to make people feel comfortable and vulnerable.
So that they can like
do their best.
Yeah.
Art. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always tried to do that, but I've always just been kind of lucky too in some respects with people that want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
I think about like early on, from the version of you that I know, there was a bunch of people around, and the ones that it seemed like stuck around or like stayed with you, like all those like early Rhymesayers tapes, there's like 15 people, it seems like rappers that are around or something. Mm-hmm. And there's like 7 that show up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, like Atmosphere used to be 2 MCs, and then one of them even faded, stopped showing up as much.
Yeah.
And then with Rhymesayers,
out of all the people that were around in the beginning, and they're all dope rappers. Like, they're all really solid MCs. But the ones that stuck with you were Musab and Sean.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then when I came, you know what I mean? Like, the people that really stay with you are people that want to really show their heart and want to, like, explore their life and put it in music.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was trying to figure, like, did you pick that out in the beginning? Like, is that something that you felt like you could see that in certain people? Like, did you choose Musab and Sean, or did that just happen?
I think it's natural, you know? But that stuff is based on how we saw music in general, and how we saw what we could do, or the possibilities, you know? Where a lot of the other people I've worked with, they were just as good, but just maybe they needed the hot track of the moment, or maybe there were, you know, things like that. Or maybe just our point of reference was different. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, me and Slug, you know, our point of reference is exactly the same.
Right.
There's, you know, it might sway a little bit when we get in our 20s, with him looking into rock music more, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I eventually jumped into that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. And then Musab, you know, he's such a charismatic character.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a love for, you know, science fiction and stuff like that, that we kind of could touch on, you know? Especially musically, when I was first working with him, you know, he would suggest things to me more back then, you know what I mean?
Mm.
He was like, yeah, man, we should use that Escape from New York. It's like, yeah, that's a good idea. We should use that. Let's do that. You know what I mean? And build it together. And then after a while, I think he was like, once we got on a similar page, he was like, just go then, you know what I mean? But once we were on the same page, I just started doing all kinds of stuff that was, you know, tailored for him.
Yeah, it's interesting, man, you talk about those reference points, and I think about, so like for you, it always like seems to me that the biggest person in your life, like as an artist and your personality and your entrance to music and everything, is your dad.
Yeah, yep. You know, you know, as big of a jerk as he was also just the funniest person I ever can remember being around.
Mm.
And, you know, and I think a lot of guys go through that. That's like your first role model.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I feel for people who don't have that sometimes, even though he was pretty much a mean guy. You know what I mean? But when he wasn't, he was pretty damn funny. But he was actually funny when he was mean too, you know what I mean? One of those dudes.
That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's like, man, he's saying some cold-blooded shit, but I'm like, trying not to laugh.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, so your dad, I mean, you're also like, your middle name is your dad's name.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you have one of the blackest names of all time.
Yeah.
Like Anthony Jerome Davis.
Yeah.
I remember one time Merce was like, man, he was like, if you were to call the crib, and this is years ago,
yeah,
when you were with a different lady, you were with a black woman, and he was like, man, if you called the house, you would swear she was white and he was black. And she had a white name, and you have the name, Anthony Jerome Davis.
Yeah.
But your dad's Jerome Davis, and he's in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, you know, like everybody that I know whose dads are in the military, especially like, in general, like black dads in the military in the 70s, like that's a certain type of dude.
You know, he was in Vietnam. So we started off there. And, but, you know, he got the heads up. And as far as my dad, you know, he was mixed, but you couldn't tell. He was just like a white dude. He's just like me, you know what I mean? My grandfather was black. My dad was just going through life like a white dude, you know what I mean? Because it was like, you know, complicated time period. But he always knew what's up, you know? And when he was in the military, it was one of those things where the draft was going on. Mm-hmm. And he joined because he didn't want to get drafted. My grandfather told him, my grandfather was in World War II. He told him, hey, you know, if you join, you can pick the department you work in.
Mm.
So if they draft you, and they're going to draft you, we're in a poor neighborhood, you have younger brothers, you know, you have two younger brothers, you're going to get drafted. There's no way around it. And this is 69 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, if you join, you can pick where you go.
Mm.
So he went in and became a mechanic, worked on tanks and jeeps and shit. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So he wasn't like in the jungle.
Oh, okay.
So his ass was like, oh man, it was okay. Especially that first tour, he had did a year over there, and then he got out for a second, and they gave him a bonus if he joined back up. And so he went back. And I think about that, and I'm like, yeah, that's a different kind of person. You did two tours over there, you know, the voluntarily, the second one, the first one's the mandatory, you know? So that's the kind of, that's the basic person that is at, when he's 20 years old and has me. And then he just became a lifer. He stayed in for 25 years.
Mm.
And we used to move around place to place, Germany and Texas, California. We lived in Monterey, California for a while. Two different trips to Germany, Oklahoma, New York for like a month. Yeah, it was like all over the place. Oh, and then finally Colorado at the end of his career. But like the beginning of my life, which is teenage years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's when I, yeah, all of who I am started really forming, I think.
In Colorado?
Colorado, yeah. From music, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that he was like really big into music, mm-hmm. and he like wanted to be a DJ or like saw himself as like mm-hmm. the music dude and his friends.
Yeah.
And so I always think like, cause I know that you and Kevin Beecham were both like military kids,
yep.
and like you guys saw each other and like maybe even were in certain same
places.
We were in
Karlsruhe in 75, and we were both the same age, and we were probably, you know, kindergarten, and we had to have been in the same school at least. We have that narrowed down. And it's interesting because it's, he's like one of the only people I can really talk to about that stuff, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of life. So it's, yeah, and he has the same story almost, you know what I mean? Which is interesting.
But I'm thinking like the records. So like this whole thing, like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I know you're like, your dad had a record collection. Because in the military, you move around the world, but also like you're with people from all over America,
yeah.
like different regions and different cultures. Like how much did the military affect the exposure to music?
Yeah, you know, it was everything. Just like any, you know, as you're a child. My dad just was really into records, really into you know, funk and soul, and then slowly start getting into jazz fusion.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 70s, it was all about that, and I think that was a way for him to make friends and stuff. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So he'd have all these records. He'd be hip on all the records and have his homies come over uh-huh. from work, and all the neighbor dudes. And they are all looking for community because they're whatever, they're from all over the world or all over the country,
mm-hmm.
and they're in this small community,
mm-hmm.
and they're just trying to all, how do we make this work, and how do, you know what I mean? It makes sense now when I look at it.
Yeah.
And so I would have my friends, and my friends would move away all the time, and I would too. And like every 3 years, you just have to swap out, or sometimes in the middle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, I just met that dude, or I just got popular,
right.
or whatever. Now I got to do this shit all over.
Yeah, man.
So I became a pretty good actor. You know, like I'm walking in the classroom,
mm-hmm.
I ain't about to be picked on.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, cause that happens. You know. You know. Mm-hmm. I know you know that too.
But just being new, that's all it takes.
Yeah, just that's
like you don't know anybody yet. You're not affiliated. It's first day in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you're not, who's going to eat this dude?
Yeah, yeah. Who's going to get him?
Yeah.
And every time I got picked on when I walked in, that dude was always end up being my best friend by the end of the year. Every time.
Because
it was always a knucklehead. I've always loved knuckleheads.
Mm-hmm.
Always have. But backtrack to when my dad and records and stuff, and his friends, and they used to all swap records and play them and stuff. And I would be a kid and just listening to how they talk. And
because
mm-hmm. that's what we do as kids. We're just like soaking in. Oh, that's how you become. That's how you get through the world or whatever. You know what I mean? That's how you have friends and mm-hmm. stuff. And My dad was aspiring. He wanted to work at a radio station. He wanted to play records. That's what he wanted to do.
Mm.
And he used to talk about, yeah, man. He was like a bullshitting type, you know what I mean? He's like, yeah, man, when I'm gonna get on a radio station, man, and you know, that type of stuff.
Mm.
I don't think he ever tried or nothing, but so I even heard hip hop for the first time through him.
Mm.
So like, it was just an extension of disco. So he would have the disco records and stuff. And then, you know, when Sugar Hill and all that stuff, that's just an extension of disco, especially as far as my dad was concerned. So I was kind of like, exposed to that in a very young age, and way before, you know, a lot of my friends would be, you know. So by the time they all got hip to, oh, hip hop's the, or rap or whatever is the thing, I was like, oh yeah, I know all that stuff just because it's been around me. Mm-hmm. So by the time I'm 82, 83, when I'm 12, 13 years old, I'm already very knowledged in so much kinds of music.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my gateway into friends.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah. It was like, oh, that Pac Jam song, you think that's tight?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is tight, but you know what? There's other ones like it, you know, that type of shit.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you talking about? It's like, yeah, man, I know I'm up on stuff because of my dad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and then you have like something to offer.
Yep.
Yeah. I had a similar thing, but it was like as a, you know, I had to like try to find people to battle or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like the ultimate. You know what I mean? Like you speak the same language.
Yeah,
like
that
like culture and art thing.
Mm-hmm. And being accepted, you know, I think we all go through stuff like that.
Yeah.
And especially then, you know, I mean, but yeah, all my life I've always been trying to, where do I feel accepted and how do I get into a comfortable place in this world?
Yeah.
And I think I've been chased. I didn't realize it. It's not the focus in my head, but it's just all my actions. When I look back, I'm like, all of my actions are based on acceptance, you know, trying to figure out where I fit in.
It's partly that, but also you have like a really deep, you've always had a really deep connection with music though.
Yeah.
Like personal, like I remember you telling me that you, like when you were a little kid, you had like your army guys and you would like set up a whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then like a lot of people did that, but then you would like play music in the background.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And score scenes for the...
When I'd be cleaning up and stuff, and I'd have like an Ennio Morricone soundtrack in my head. I'd be like 5 years old, like after I'm cleaning up the soldiers and stuff.
He's like
dun 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 cleaning up shit. You know?
Yeah.
And my dad used to get a kick out of that. He used to be like, he'd catch me playing in there with music theme songs and
like
me.
You were singing it or
Both. I would do both. But I'd definitely be singing a lot of the singing it stuff. And he'd be like, yeah, man. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, you should, you know, give me suggestions. Yeah, you should mix the soldiers with the cowboys, the cowboy guys and them dinosaurs, man. It could be like a, that was it. Yeah. It's like time travelers, man.
It's crazy. So I'm saying like you saw him like trying to connect with people and then you were able to connect with people. But
yeah,
is that the thing that you actually felt good about with him was music?
With music, because I remember, because he would like, the way he would talk about it, like he would play something. I remember he would play and I would see the like record covers, you know, and the record covers laying around and I would just look at him and like, oh, that's crazy, you know? Mm-hmm. And he would, you know, like he'd play like some, like Herbie Hancock's Headhunters, and like I'm a little kid and he's just like, man, check that out or whatever, and you're just like, okay, yeah, I'll check it out, yeah, okay, you know what I mean, and he's like, he's fascinated, so I'm fascinated, and we're having some small connection, me and him, where we don't normally, you know. I was never into sports and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I didn't start watching sports until I was an adult. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never played and all that stuff. And for him, that was, you had to do sports or you're like, you're not a guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's how he looked at the world.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you better do sports or you're not part of my tribe. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But the music thing was how I eventually eventually got in with him,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. And slowly but surely, you know, I guess the when I start sneaking his records to do hip hop stuff, you know. yeah.
It's crazy. I was really similar. Like my dad was boxer, football player. Like he was that type of dude.
Yeah.
Like he was like a tough kind of dude. And that was not really my thing. I mean, obviously I had my share of fights and stuff like
that.
Because I convinced myself I had to.
Yeah.
And sometimes I really did have to.
But
man, the music thing was something that I didn't really understand till later, but like when I look back on it, like he always liked that I did it.
Yeah. Dude, I remember one time I was like in third grade, I was fighting this cat we were playing football. And like I said, I didn't play sports, but you know, you just do some regular street stuff and messing around out there. And I got in a fight and I got beat up, you know, and apparently he was watching the whole time from up in the top window, just watching. Came in the house, he was like, Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know what to tell you, man. You know, I was like, oh, dude, I was so embarrassed, you know? I feel like that dude only caught all my embarrassing shit. Yeah, he never saw none of my tightness. You know what I mean? Yeah, now that I think about it. Anything that was cool about me, that motherfucker did not see it. Until way, way, way late, yeah.
So like you were like fully.
Yeah.
Did he ever like, I don't even know if I met him. Like, did he come to shows? Like, did he ever come around stuff?
Yeah. But out in Vegas. So that's probably why you didn't.
Because I try to avoid that place.
Yeah. And he lived there when he retired.
Mm.
So he lived there. And so he would go to the Vegas shows and stuff.
Is it the House of Blues there?
There's a House of Blues there. There's a bunch of shit out there. I mean, one time he came to one of a festival we did out there.
Mm.
It was like Vegas or something. I don't remember. Shit like that.
Oh, he came to that?
He came to that, and that was the first time he's seen me, actually. It was funny because it was like a Daft Punk show. Like, them guys were playing, Public Enemy was playing, Cypress Hill, all the greats. All these great people were playing, and we were like in the middle. We were playing like five or six and on the little stage, right? And it was a big tent. And I think it was Blackalicious maybe that played right before us or something, or right after. I can't remember. I think maybe right before us. And after they got off the stage, they cleared out the tent.
Mm.
They pushed everybody out so that for the fire, you know, whatever. I don't remember. And we got to do a line check. And they think nothing of it. And when we started the set back then, I remember it being trying to find a balance.
At the beginning of the set?
At the beginning of the set, which is kind of weird. But we had the full band. And this was just the DJ's part.
Okay.
I think. Anyway, the long story short, my dad was like in the middle, like kind of by the soundboard because he was old ass dude. They weren't tripping on him just walking around. And he was just standing there. And then when they let everybody in, they all kind of ran.
Mm.
And all these kids just ran to the front. Blah, blah. My dad was like, oh shit. Like, I thought I was going to be the only one here.
Crazy.
And it was packed. Yeah. Yeah.
That's dope.
So that was the first time he saw that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like 05 or something.
So you got exposed to hip hop through him. And then, but I mean, then you got like fully.
Yeah. You know, I want to back to, when did, I don't think I ever knew this about, did your dad ever come see you?
One time.
Really? Once?
One time. Yeah. He saw me with Doom.
Really?
Yeah. And it was a really bad, it was the worst show of the tour.
Really? Was that first ever?
No, I was in Philly. It was like after he had gone to Philly.
Okay.
And I didn't know he was coming. It was like, me and him were okay at that point. Because after my mom died, I made a point of like, because I was always closer with my mom. But then I went on the God Loves Ugly tour and came back.
Mm-hmm.
And she got cancer and died like 2 months later. Like it was like that, quick. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, and me and her weren't in a good place when she died.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, okay, with my dad, I'm going to try to have as much, whatever relationship I can.
Yeah.
So I was in that phase where I would like literally set on my phone to call him the 15th of every month.
Oh, wow.
And I would just talk till I couldn't stand it anymore. And I would just be like, all right, man. And I think, I can't remember like where we were at with everything, but he just showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on tour with Doom. And so I remember like, wanting to impress Doom. You know what I'm saying? Because like that, like Doom was Doom.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I wanted to do well, and I was like trying to, you know, I was still getting to know him. And then my dad just showed up at soundcheck. Like he was just there all of a sudden. Mm. And it really threw me off. And then I don't remember, I don't know if the show was as bad as I thought it was, but like also I couldn't see on stage and it was boomy and I couldn't really hear. And I just remember feeling like, oh man, if he was going to see something, I wish he was seeing a better show.
It's interesting though. Yeah.
Yeah. And my mom never got to see any of it.
Yeah.
Like she didn't see anything. No. I mean, she also came to like a show, but like she might have seen a like a Red Sea or show or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, she never saw any of that.
Yeah.
So I know you like talked about the moments of hearing hip hop music.
Yeah.
And knowing the samples.
Mm-hmm.
So like what was that? What was that early time?
When I really got into hip hop real heavy was when Run DMC came out in 83. When that's really when I really was like, okay, this is really what I'm about.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was just like, okay, I'm a guy that just happens to know what this stuff is.
Mm.
Like when Tom Tom Club was the biggest record in the world in certain environments, I was the man that knew that, oh, there's another version called The Genius of Love by Grandmaster Flash. You should check that out.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew all that kind of stuff. And they were just covers, kind of, the beats were like, you know, how that stuff was. Anyway, so I just always had a basic knowledge. And then when scratching became more and more in songs, Grandmaster Flash, once again, had a record called Girls Love the Way He Spins.
Mm.
And they were scratching the the Earth, Wind, and Fire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also scratching, That's a Fire, the Eddie Murphy thing.
Oh.
And they were scratching, he was scratching up My Grandma and Your Grandma, sitting by, all this stuff. And I was like, oh man, I know what all these things are. You know what I mean? I know what these scratch sound, I know what they come from.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I didn't, I at least knew them in my memory, like, oh, I know that from playing around the house. You know what I mean? So that was another thing, you know? And by then I was trying to learn how to scratch, like, which is, you know, there was times my mom and dad used to break up all the time. And so it was always back, besides being back and forth in the military, my mom and dad were constantly breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
So I would live, you know, in different situations like that too. And she had a Montgomery Ward turntable. And it was like the old knob thing. You just put the record, you know, it had the tape deck.
Mm-hmm.
And you put the, I'd put the record on and use the knob. And I don't know how I knew that you were supposed to use a volume. I had no idea. I don't know how I learned that.
Mm.
Someone must have showed me and I forgot the guy's name or something. You know what I mean? But I don't know how I figured it out. But I used to try to record that. But you couldn't record
the
volume.
Right.
So that was always weird to me. And so I started trying to learn like that. And when I played Sucker MCs one time, I went, bah, 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 crack, crack, kip it, kip it, crack, crack, kip it. Just, I was like, holy shit. I just did a Jam Master Jay thing.
Like I just did it. Yeah.
I just did it. Yeah. And I was like, oh, and that, I think that was the first official drug. I think since then, if I had to guess, it's been just all consuming at some point or another, you know, and being able to do that and then kind of showing a couple guys and them going, whoa, you know, that acceptance thing.
Yeah.
And then when I got back, my mom got back with my dad, you know, he had a mixer, but he used to have the old disco mixer and they didn't have headphones. They didn't have a cue. So all you people out there that don't know about the mixer, DJ mixer, a cue is a headphone so you could hear the other song playing before you let it go. And that's how you could mix on beat. But back in at that time, they existed, but my dad just didn't have one of those with the cue. And that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so my first time touching a turntable with a mixer, still I didn't have a cue, so I used to put the record on and just kind of like do it, you know.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird.
But did it have a fader or just have
no like, it just had just the like up slide. And down. Yeah. Yep. No fader. Yep. Yep. I think it had a knob too.
It's crazy. Yeah. like Premiere still cuts like that.
Oh yeah, like that.
Like he still cuts with that. Like
yeah,
not,
so
not
do,
with the
so do I.
Yeah.
So do I.
Oh, you do still cut like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I barely use the crossfader.
Mm.
Just because I'd never learned like that.
Mm.
And it was funny when transforming became a style, the old realistic mixers had these little, this little switch.
Yeah.
That, and I thought that that's how you did it. I didn't know that, like, because Jazzy Jeff can do a crossfader, but I'm like, that's impossible.
Yeah.
So I used to use a switch. That's how I learned.
Those things break if you do that though.
Yeah. It's funny because they actually, to this day, I still have like a, my thumb is still kind of hardened because I just, with that little switch, and it was like the hard switch. And so I did that for like 5-6 years. Like that style. So now everything I do is backwards because I learned backwards.
Uh-huh.
I learned backwards with the switch thing. And because I learned, and I, the way I had this turntable set, I didn't have a crossfader.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is different, you know? And so by the time all these other things become more and more accessible, I'm already, it's like 89.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
did you ever put the turntables like two on the same side?
Yeah, that's always did it.
Yeah,
I always did it that way, and then so my everything's just a little backwards now.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. But I made it work, obviously. And yeah.
But a lot of great ones do that though.
Yeah. You know, you just learn. It's how you learn and what you learn. And I just, yeah.
I always think about it like playing the guitar left-handed. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like Jimi Hendrix played the guitar upside down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he didn't know they had left-handed guitars, so he just learned how to do it with the other hand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
It's pretty great. But yeah, so by the time I got a mixer with a Q, which is probably 85 or something. And back then it seemed like a year was eternity. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just seemed like it took forever for things. But it was, I look back and I'm like, the jumps I made from 84 to 85, 86 and all these things and learning how to, discovering what a four track was, all these weird little things, you know, even though I didn't get a four track until the 90s, but budget had a lot to do with stuff back then.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have money a lot of times.
At that time, you couldn't convince your parents that you were a musician.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like if you played the cello or the trumpet or the guitar or something like that was being a musician.
Dude, yeah.
Like if you were doing music, like if you were messing with hip hop, then you were just breaking their
stuff.
Yeah.
But my dad was a little hip because he was the first one to really show me, like, he was like, you know, a record was playing and he's like, you hear that? What instrument is that? And I was like, I'm not sure. He's like, oh, that's scratching. But he thought it was done like with the needle, like that. He was like,
Yeah,
oh, really? Oh, okay. Interesting. And I was like, yeah, it was early on. And then, but when I started practicing all the time, a little later on, you know, I remember when I was like 16 or something, I'd be in there practicing whatever. And he'd go, damn, man, sound like a chainsaw in there. Damn, boy, turn that shit down. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But here's the funniest part. So I started being able to do like a DST's routine, which is Rocket and Wild Style, Time Zone Wild Style. Jam Master J, I could do his routine and I practiced them every day.
Mm.
And one time he had his buddies over and it was like some young GIs. Like he was a sergeant by then. This is the 80s. So he's a sergeant.
Mm.
So he has privates and stuff that are like brand new to the military, has him over the house for drinks, talking shit or whatever, trying to act cool, making up stories. And he goes, oh man, you guys want to check out my son? Check this dude out, man. Watch this, man. He goes, hey, Tony. I was like, yeah. He goes, hey, do one of them things you do, man. You know, he's like, let these cats check it out. And I was like, all right. And I know, cause they're young brothers and shit. You know what I mean? Like they're like 20 years old. They're going to know what I'm about to do. They have no idea what's coming, you know what I mean? And I'm break out the Wild Style routine. And they're like, yo, holy shit, they're tripping.
Dope.
And my dad was like, oh yeah, is that good? Kind of, but like playing it off like, yeah. Because he never would give credit or props or anything.
Mm.
Ever. But that moment was fond to me. I bet you that sparked 20 years worth of my career. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
That had to have.
Because
it was like the only time I think he's ever been like, he didn't say I'm proud of you, but he was like, yo.
Yeah.
Showing these young guys and he's getting accepted.
He's getting points from the
young
yeah,
guys.
Because
of me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I guess I didn't totally get it at the time, but I did. I think I've always been have a lot of intuition to me. Yeah, that was a moment. It was definitely a moment. And it happened a few more times after that, but there was nothing like that first time. That first time was like, and then I think it gave me confidence, like, oh, I can actually do something that not a lot of people can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was off to the races then.
Anyone that's been listening to our music for any length of time, I think you get a sense of the fact that we're making music, but this is also a creative movement that starts with the music. It starts with the relationship between the people who make the music. That relationship then extends to the people that listen to it and support it. And so it's an artistic movement, it's a creative movement, but it's not only about the music. We're looking to create an environment in the music, but also create a little section of the world that reflects what we find to be beautiful and what we find to be right. And so when we brought this music to the world initially, we had record labels at first that were completely ignoring us. But then once they started to see that you were supporting it and that there were people that were responding and that we're filling a need that people didn't even know they had, which is always the case when you share what's really going on inside of you, you find out that what's most personal to you is also most universal, that there are other people that when you share your secrets, they're like, oh man, I have a similar secret to that. And it makes me know that I'm not alone and that connection is really beautiful. But then the record industry wanted to get involved. You know what I'm saying? But it's always been really important to us that this isn't only about music. It's really a creative movement for us to carve out a little section of the world that's about what we believe in. And what's really important going into this next phase, we've been in this thing for many phases, but the phase that we're in now is we're in the era of the algorithm. And the algorithm is programmed by people, but it's there for the same reason that the huge corporations are there, just to get tonnage of human attention so that they can use that attention to sell their stuff. And that on its own isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what they believe in the section of the world that they've carved out, which is unfortunately all these streaming platforms, they believe that the best way to attract human attention is by promoting the lowest common denominator, the worst of our nature that we all share. We've all got it. We're all petty. We all have opinions. We all like to argue about them. We all get some sense of enjoyment out of judging people. But the research and the data, and even before that, just on a gut level, we could feel that these things are fueling division between people. They're fueling a sense of anger between people, and we don't have any interest in participating in that. This music is about connection. This podcast is about connection. This movement is about connection. It's based on something pure and real and true, and we don't just want to sell it to big corporations, and we don't want to have to make our decisions based on what's going to get a lot of clicks and shares and likes and heat and algorithmic robotic attention and prioritizing. We don't want to do that. The same way that we didn't want to jump into the music industry that was about promoting certain ideas, we're not just trying to feed the machine. And so what we do here is just like our musical movement. It's based on our relationship with you. And so just like you used to go to a show, you used to buy a ticket, you used to buy a CD and t-shirts. Hopefully you still do all that stuff because we're still making dope music. We still throw amazing concerts. I think that the people from my cohort, I think we're at our best point now. Like, this is a resurgence of our type of music, our approach to music. And man, I'm telling you, you go to some of these shows and you listen to some of the music that's being made by the people from our cohort of artists, and it is phenomenal. It's phenomenal. So the way that you support this now, though, is by going to brotherali.com. In the join section, we have something called a caravan. You can jump in at the $5 level. And there's all sorts of ways to connect there. There's Ask Me Anything episodes. People challenge me about stuff. People ask me about my views on things. So we do those regularly. But there is an ever-growing collection of rare and exclusive music and podcast episodes and lectures and talks. There's an oral history of my demo tape called Rites of Passage. You know what I'm saying? Which is just the very, very beginning of my career, where I just sit down and talk through the entire process of making that demo tape. And you can also listen to Rites of Passage there. It's not streaming on any of the streaming services. You can also listen to our mixtapes. There's all sorts of stuff there that you can't find anywhere else, along with exclusive stuff. Speaking of great new music in this category of artists, Slug and Ant just put out this amazing new album. And called So Many Other Realities Exist Simultaneously. And Slug, in a really unprecedented, really very special kind of moment, he and I talked through what that album is about, track by track, the story of the album, the arc of the album. He almost never explains his art in that way. And he was really generous to do it with us. There's a conversation with Chris Calico, who went independent, you know what I'm saying, from Strange Music and from his dear friend Tech N9ne, right around the time that I went independent and we launched Travelers Media, you know what I'm saying, after being with my dearest friends, Slug and Ant, you know what I'm saying, in their label and in the label that they're a part of and helped to found. And so Chris Calico and I have a conversation. There's a dope podcast episode, but we had a whole conversation with his wife, where his wife, Crystal, gets on with us, and we talk about mental health and running the business and all of this amazing stuff. So go to brotherali.com in the join section and join the caravan, and let's keep this movement strong. So it's like the music in that time with your dad and his friends, but then also Richard Pryor, too.
Yeah, no, just as huge, maybe even huger, way earlier, because... You know, there's another thing. My dad would play those early Richard Pryor records around the house, mm-hmm. and have his friends over, and they'd hang out and laugh. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? They play a Richard Pryor record, y'all just hanging around the couch smoking weed and listening and cracking up. That's the thing, you know? That's the thing they would do all the time, you know, it seemed like. And I just listen. And, you know, I'm like eight, 9 years old, listening to this shit, like, two dudes. And I'm like, oh, man, that's funny. And then I could go outside and start talking just like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, hey, you motherfuckers don't know shit, right? You know, that type of thing. Yeah. You know, so I started kind of like just talking like that, mm-hmm. to make the neighborhood kids think I was something. And then it's stuck. And like, I can't get rid of it sometimes. It just comes around. Like, sometimes I'm just around the house, like, oh, these bitches out here. Oh shit! Sorry.
Yeah, your kids are just like.
I don't know why, but I'm really good at not cussing around my kids. I don't know what it is about that, but you know what I'm saying, like, there's things slip out here and there. My wife will tell you that actually I'm not good at it, but I don't know. I think I'm real proud of myself, but because half the shit I want to say I don't say.
Yeah, man. And that became like that, like anybody that knows you, especially people that knew you in the time, like when you first started touring.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like that was, man.
That's just everything.
Yeah, to this day, like it's hard for me to hear Richard Pryor and not hear you.
Yeah, it's really, he was such a big inspiration for me. And then as I got older and I started understanding the other part, like the more vulnerable stuff.
Yeah.
And I started being like, oh, like you can talk with, like I never heard my dad talk like that. I could tell he wanted to. You know what I mean? But like certain things that were just sensitive, you know what I mean? And by the way, when I'm saying all this stuff, my mom was the sweetest person in the world and very, very supportive, even though she might've been just bullshitting, but she was like, yeah, Tony, you can make music and yeah, you know, happy white lady, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, she had her things, issues too, but she was great with that stuff with me. Mm. And I don't want to leave her all out there like that, but so that was her support. It was everything, you know, because that was another thing where she would try to get me new records or, you know, she didn't have a lot of money and either did my dad, but my dad was very selfish anyway. Mm. Anyway, but the Richard Pryor stuff was, it just became, like I said, I don't think I've ever even said that part out loud before. Mm. The idea of hearing that stuff and then taking it outside and using it to make friends, mm-hmm. or just to make people laugh, or whatever, you know, whatever I was doing. You know?
The stuff that you've made and the stuff that you're known for is really like such a knowledge of records and mm-hmm. samples, you know what I mean? All that stuff. But then also that talk and fly, the acceptance thing, and then the sensitivity piece with Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Like, it just really feels like, man, that orientation, you know what I mean? That initial thing that like, this is what's important. Mm-hmm. This is how you connect with people. This is how you, talk. This is how you express yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
But then also just the idea that an artist, when you really are doing something, is when you're opening up mm-hmm. and when you're showing that other side of who you are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It really feels like that's the gateway to all of the music that you made.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what else to say to that one. I think you're right.
But you mentioned also that you're good at like reading people.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's such a huge part of it too. Like we mentioned that you were focusing on this in hip hop music in a time when I don't know how popular that was. Mm. Like your first stuff that I was aware of came out in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
And that's a time when there was only like a couple types of rappers to be. Mm. Like you could either be like Heavy D, you could be like the super positive rapper, you could be a gangster rapper, mm-hmm. or you could be a black power rapper.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
that was really it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or, different types of like fly player, whatever. Yeah. But it wasn't really common for people to like open up. Very rare examples.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Rare people. Yeah,
yeah, like certain like Scarface and things mm-hmm. like that have moments like that. Mm-hmm. But your ability to see who a person is underneath what they're showing the world and being like, I want to get to that.
Yeah.
Where do you think you learn how to know people like that, read people like that, and to try to bring it out in music?
I guess it would have to be with my relationship with my dad and the sensitivity my mom had. She was she's a very sensitive person. Mm. So I had that. But then my dad, because you can't really talk to him, you know, he talks to you. You don't talk to him.
Mm.
So you have to be a certain way around him and read him. I used to have to know when it was okay to at least kind of ask something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or when it was time to be, I see. He cracked a little smile right there. I can talk about something with them. You know what I mean? Like, I just learned how to do that shit. You have to read his ass. Know what's what. And I feel like there's a big pile on my dad, but it's not. You know what I mean? It's just what it is. But I just had to read him. And then I start doing that with everything and everybody, because that's just how that is. And this is obviously just me looking back now. I don't, you know what I mean?
Like, you don't know that when it's happening.
Yeah, it's just like, this is how you would deal with people. And this is how you deal with like guys and shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like, I ain't talking to you first. You out of your mind? You know what I mean?
Right.
You talk to me and then I'll engage if necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just depends what you bring in. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, but when I was a kid, it started off a little bit like, okay, is it cool? You know what I mean? That type of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so I think as I went into music, I started noticing right away. So right in the 80s, I've been making music pretty, like I was saying, I started working with rappers in 88, 89, stuff like that. Maybe actually before that, like 85 even, I was doing parties and stuff with rappers and all kinds of stuff. Trying to make songs and learning how to make songs. And I would notice sometimes if I say something, I would watch somebody get defensive, but I wouldn't know what that, I'd be like, oh, this dude's ready to go to mattresses over this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people could hear a criticism or some people, and I was the same way. Someone would be like, Tony, man, you need to scratch better on beat, man. You know, like, so, what you crazy motherfucker on beat? That was not a fuck up of the cut. You know what I mean? Like, that type of shit. You know what I mean? So it's pretty funny. Yeah. So that was always a thing. And so I was like, I had to figure out how to talk to guys about their art. and realizing, oh, these guys, they care about it just like I do.
Yeah.
And they're sensitive to it. I need to be sensitive to what they're doing and what they're putting down and what they, you know, they're writing. Even though it's knick-knack paddywhack raps, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's still serious. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, and as I grew and as things grew, I just learned more and more. This is how I start dealing with people. And that's, to this day, it's like that, you know?
I feel like that's one of the things that I've learned from you is like, what's the main thing that, like, why is this person doing this? And what's the, what do they want out of it?
Yeah. Yeah. There's all a lot of that, but I can't ever really put my finger on it. I just get around people and I just assume you're like me. I feel like if you're an artist, you're most likely something happened to you where you're looking for acceptance. And somewhere around the way, somebody didn't. That was important. And they didn't accept you. So maybe if I show you just a little bit of, I feel the same way you do, or we can accept each other for these very, maybe something as simple as, oh man, I got zits and you got zits and let's become, you know what I mean? Whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
that's how you do it as an 80s thing.
Yeah, zits. I don't think they even have those no more, but, you know, like, but I'm just saying, you know what I mean?
Yeah, man, what happened to zits, man?
But, you know, it's like, it's a, you know, so it's just kind of like, you're just, you're bonding with artists, you know what I mean? And so making sure to talk about, you know, and I'm not a curious mind. I'm really not too curious about what with people. But when I start talking with artists, I'm always fascinated at how their brains work. And why they do the things they do, because I know it's all showing off. I don't care what nobody says. It's we're all the same in that department. We're all like, hey, look what I can do.
right.
At some degree or another. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's all a bunch of little kids with their little drawings. Hey, look at that. You know what I mean? Like, it's all, everybody's the same with that shit.
Yeah.
So I always think about that when I'm working with any artist, no matter big or small, you know, I think about that because they're all like that to me.
I do really remember, like, when we started, like, really working together. I remember, like you said, like, you don't see it when it's happening. But, like, I was aware that you were really careful how you were talking to me about certain things. But now looking back, like, I see, like, how you had to open me up to certain things. And when I think about, like, even, like, when we're making Shadows on the Sun, like, I think about the first songs we made. To the last.
Yeah.
Because
the
first was Room with a View. We made Room with a View, Bitch Slap.
Yeah. Hardcore joints.
My neighborhood's crazy and I smack rappers.
Yeah.
Like
that's
where we started.
The basics.
Yeah.
The basics.
So by the time we got to the end, it was Picket Fence. You know what I mean? It was just like, and then you know what I mean? And then no one loved me, but then one person did.
It's all of us.
And I know that was like That's over the course of a year. Of just you like slowly.
Whether I knew it or not, but But there was, but I always knew you had an interesting story. You know what I mean? You would tell me these little things. But you were also so, when I first met you, you were very, very hard guy. You know what I mean?
Just
very, and I always tell you the first time I met you, you don't even know, remember this really, but you were playing at a coffee shop. And you were on stage and there was 50 people, maybe more. It was kind of a packed coffee house. You got off stage and I was like, dude, this is like some Karis One type shit. And I was like, yo, man, you were, and I don't, like I said, I don't go talking to people. You're out of your mind. So I was like, yo, man, that shit was amazing. That was great. Or dope, whatever word I use. And you were just like, I was like, all right, what, you know, all good. And fast forward however long, maybe a year, I don't know what it was. And then you came over with Musab. My gateway, Musab's my gateway to everybody I know pretty much.
It's funny. I don't remember that. But I do remember, I remember the first time I introduced you to Brendan. And like you were coming from work because you were like a janitor at that time.
And you
would like sneak out on your lunch break at work and like come to hip hop shows. But you still had those clothes on.
And
I remember I was like, this is Ant. And he was like, oh, what up, Ed? Ed. He was like, oh, hey, Ed. I was like, no, that's Ed. And he was like, oh.
That's funny.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So when you started working with rappers, like I know on the Melodies and Memories tapes, you have like those like samples from parties.
Yeah.
People don't know, like those are actual parties that you were DJing at as a teenager.
As a teenager, yeah.
Like from the time period of that you...
1986, it says it on the tape. Yeah, Deerfield parties.
Crazy.
Yeah, two different ones. And two different, like 6 months apart even. Mm. But I knew all the records and break beats, but I didn't know what Big Beat was from. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was Billy Squier. But I knew that the Roxanne had the replay technically of Big Beat, and there was 8 bars with no scratching on the instrumental. So I had 2 copies of that, and I'd cut it back and forth, and that was my version of the Big Beat. But it sounded a little different, you know, obviously, because of the Roxanne thing. And then people at the party were like, "Yo!" And they would get up on the mic and start rapping, and I'd cut that beat back and forth for like 20 minutes. 20 minutes, we'd go forever, you know. People just go up there. And so I used to always record all those parties. And I just took the highlights from that for my mixtape. Yeah. And when he says, Tony on the cut, you know
what's how fresh.
And you know what's funny about that motherfucker is that dude's name's Pee Wee. And I knew him when I was also in Germany. So this was in Colorado, this DJ thing that happened. This was in Colorado, 1985, 86. I knew this kid back in 78, something like that, in Germany. Whole different situation, whole different everything. It was crazy. Sometimes you would bump into people like that in the military.
Yeah.
There's these little pockets of communities, you know, that their dads would be sent over here, you'd be sent over there, and then somehow you get bumped back into each other and weird shit.
Who are like the early dudes and like what are the things that stand out about those? Because like you had rappers, like I've heard about these people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I almost feel like I know them. Like over the years, I've heard all these stories. Of, yeah, then this dude did that and then that guy said that. And then.
Dude, Pee Wee, you know, I can't even believe I'm talking about his ass. But, you know, he sounded like Steady B. Mm. You know what I mean? Like Steady B was new, hot shit. Pee Wee was new, hot shit. He was just ill, but he was like. He was like the only dude I knew who had Fila's, you know what I mean? Like no one knew what that was.
Yeah.
He just moved because he was new. He was new to school, but I knew him from Germany. He kind of remembered me. I don't know if he did, but I remembered him plain as day because he's always one of them knock a motherfucker out type guys. You know what I mean? So, and we got along pretty good. And then, man, this fool stole my drum machine, man.
Which one was it?
It was a drum machine I stole. So go figure. You know what I mean? As per usual, when my thieving career came into play. Yeah. By the time that happened. But I had this drum machine that I stole.
From a hotel?
A hotel ballroom. I was just fucking around, walking around this hotel. Don't ask me why. We're just cutting through it, I think. Cutting through the hotel to go to another side of the town. Who knows? We're walking through there, and I see all this equipment set up for, like, they're going to have a jam that night.
It's like a wedding or something.
A wedding or something like that. And I'm like, yo, that's an RX-5 drum machine.
The Yamaha joint.
Yeah. And I knew that because my homie Terry T, one of my older homies, had one. Mm. And I was like, I got to get that. So I just took it. I feel bad about it to this day. I feel bad. I actually feel worse than I'm laughing about it. What you gonna do?
I mean, it's funny.
You're a kid. Yeah. You're a kid, right? So I took that, and it's funny because I never really got good at it or anything like that. And it had all the corny ass sounds on it.
Those sounds were terrible. They're the worst. That was my first drum machine was the RX-7.
Oh, okay.
The one right after that. Yeah, but it was basically the same thing.
Piece of junk.
Yeah, it had like a little bass sound. Don't.
Oh, I have that over there actually.
The RX-7.
Yeah. Right. Is that? What does that say on there?
It's right here?
Yeah.
DD5.
Oh, DD5. Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, the RX-7 was like this, and it like sloped up.
Okay.
And it had a little window on it and like things. And it had like little fake James Brown samples on it.
Yeah.
It was some white guy going, hey, funky, get down.
Yeah, all that shit. Yeah, and this one did too. But I would just like, it was funny too, because I might get my guy Terry T, and I'd go, doom, doom, crack, doom, doom, crack. He's like, that's it? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, don't you want to put some like some hi-hats and shit? I was like, no, man, no, what's that shit?
Crazy.
Yeah, like he was right, but you know, at the time, no. You kick snare only. That's all you use. And scratches.
And scratches.
That's
yeah.
it. You don't do nothing else. Are you out of your mind?
Yeah, because that's Teela Rock.
yeah, Teela Rock. And yeah. So anyway, I lent that to Pee-wee. And I never seen his ass again. Yeah. He got So that's karma for you.
Yeah, man. That's like such a big part of it is like the like I always think about like what producers and DJs have to deal with working with rappers. Like that's such a big part of it is like managing us. So like we talked about like part of the thing is you have to manage our sensitivities, our like egos around our music, but also just like managing we're really strange people.
And very much especially in public because there's a different persona in public usually than on in person.
Yeah.
One-on-one there's usually pretty dramatic. Gotta deal with that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Also like when you go in public you're like who's this person?
This like motherfucker's that. Cocky as shit. Right now. Like, that ain't the cat I know.
You don't look like that when you're trying to figure them last four bars out.
Yeah, you know. But that's definitely when I was younger.
You weren't saying that when you were eating that pork.
yeah. That's funny. That's real funny.
Managing rappers and
rappers. Yeah. And then managing yourself and, you know, because I can just be just as egotistical as anybody else and I can be sensitive too, especially back then. More so, you know, but as it grew and it just became more and more my focus in my life. Obviously, I did have like a little spell of doing some criminal activity only for another reason, the same acceptance. I was never because I needed money. It was never that. I had a job and I still would steal. I had like a grocery store job and I would steal because it was fun. You know what I mean? I learned real quick that I like action. You know what I mean? I like action. I like partying at that time and drinking and all that. And by the time I was 21, I stopped all that technically.
Yeah.
I stopped the drinking and I stopped the partying and I stopped, obviously stopped crime and all that. I just got scared straight and I was just, and I started just doing music only, focusing only on music. And I even tried to quit music though for a while. For like 6 months or something when I moved to Minnesota from Colorado
because you're about to like get serious about
life. I'm gonna be a real person now,
an adult.
I'm gonna get rid of all the crime, all the partying, weird stuff I did, and all the record stuff and all that. What am I doing making demos, you know,
especially at that time. If you're 21, it's like you're already like middle age.
It's at that time, yeah, no doubt about it.
In hip hop music,
right? Yeah. There was this one time I did this DJ battle with this couple of army dudes, and I got second place, right? And back then the DJ battle had nothing to do with scratches. It was like, could you get people to dance on the dance floor?
Okay, it was like Busy Bee type.
Yeah, you had to get people on the dance floor.
Okay.
And I don't know what made me think that boom, boom, chuck from Kraftwerk was gonna work, but it kind of did. But anyway, point being, I got second place and I won some studio time. And this is 86, 87, something like that.
That's major.
Yeah, major thing. And it's like 20 hours or something, 10
That's
hours.
A lot,
yeah,
dude.
It's a lot.
Crazy.
But I'd never been to studio, so I had no idea. And me and my guy, my dude Steve, he had the first EPS. But it was this the whack 808 sounds of the time. They weren't like the 808 machine. It was the knockoff 808 drum sounds that the EPS came with. So we had that and we had the drum beat. And I spent all the time cutting the records on top of it because we couldn't sample.
Right.
We didn't know how to sample and loop and all that stuff because we didn't know the machines really. And we didn't know studio.
Like that's how the Jungle Brothers made their records, right?
Technically, but they didn't even have a drum machine though.
They were just backspinning records.
But yeah, for the most part.
Yeah.
From what I could tell. But I was doing it kind of like, how Peter Piper was probably made.
Okay.
Because that was my reference point.
Drum machine and then cut the record
on top of it.
Which is, that's how you made your mixtapes.
That's how I made my mixtapes, yeah. But at the time, I didn't know that because I'm in the studio. I got 10 hours or whatever. And I realized that in four of them hours, I still haven't finished this beat, really. I got the drum machine down and I'm spending all this time trying to lay this drum break on top of it to get it to sound like some real shit. And we haven't even got to the vocals yet. Mm. And so it was like, and because it's taken me forever to lay it on time right. Because you know what I mean? It's a process. I wasn't that good at it yet. I ended up eventually being really, really good at it. But at first, and that's when I learned there's no such thing as studio. You have to have a four track. You have to do it yourself. You have to have a demo and you have to memorize it. Then you go in the studio and pay or whatever because it's expensive and know what you're going to do. And that started the whole demo thing forever and ever up to this day, kind of.
Yeah.
And now that you guys have excellent equipment at your house now, it's
we
different.
We record ourselves. Yeah, but great. Even that, I mean, it's still a similar principle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We still relay things and redo things and touch things and all that before you take the files to the studio.
Yeah. So I learned all that from that experience. That was one of my biggest experiences was like, I can't do this in that amount of time. Yeah. I don't have enough money to do that. So I need to just save up all that money I would on studio time and just buy a four track or whatever. And get together with my guy, Steve. And we went together on a bunch of stuff. Mm. He had a little more money than me with his criminal activity compared to mine, but we got together. And
how deep did you actually get like in the criminal thing? Like what was it? It was
only stealing stuff. I never did drug stuff. I never did none of that. I used to steal cars and rob houses and stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's serious enough.
Yeah. It's pretty embarrassingly bad. Mm. And I did it, you know, from I'd say 16, and then it got worse when I turned 18, mm-hmm. and that's when you shouldn't be doing it because then you're an adult, you're getting adult time. So I started getting caught all the time for stuff, and then I got put on probation for a long time.
Yeah,
and then and a big fine. When they gave me this fine too, it was like 50 grand. I was 18 years old and
1989. Crazy.
And I'm like,
$50,000 at that sounds time, like, it might as well be a million.
Dude, because if I'm like, I'm lucky if I make $7,000 a year at that time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or something.
And I mean, people were buying houses for
$50,000. Yeah.
Like at that time.
Yeah. And it was like my dad would say, you know, he's like, that's your education. That's your college right there.
Yeah.
You know, that's your college.
And did you have to, like, were you inside? Did you have to like
go? No, I didn't go to jail. No, I went to jail a few times, but like a couple of weeks or weekends, and went to workhouse once. Went to workhouse for like a month, and that was kind of funny because my job, it was like a work release thing, and my job was car wash, and it used to rain all the time and shit. It was like in the winter time, it was snowing and raining all the time, so I barely worked, but I was always leaving and going. But the deal was you had to make a certain dollar amount to pay for your stay, for your workhouse stay. So that was the only time in my life I think my dad gave me some money. It's like, okay, here's a couple hundred bucks or whatever. Probably literally the only time I could recall him ever giving me money. Matter of fact, I gave him a lot of money. I bought those records from him. He didn't hand me down records. I bought that shit.
Oh, I didn't know
those big ass speakers and so in Vegas. Yeah. I bought those from him. I bought all that shit from
like
him.
Before Atmosphere took off. Like,
oh, way before like, all that. Yeah, way before all that. Yeah.
You bought that whole collection from him?
Yeah. But it was like, it's like 20 crates, which is a lot to a normal person.
Right.
But now I've got like 400 crates now. Yeah. You know what I mean? Something weird. I'm weird now. I'm really weird. But yeah, I bought all that from him. Because he moved to CDs because the big CD revolution of the early 90s.
Okay.
That's when I did my big come ups. Because everybody was getting rid of all their records and I was just swooping in.
Yeah. Records were a dollar at that time.
Yeah. No one cared about them. No one cared. You know? I used to go to a place at a record store called Landfill. Yeah. And then when the cheapos used to throw their records over there, all the beat up ones, mm-hmm. and they were 50 cent, you know. And all my first, in like early 92, 93, some of my prized possessions are from that time period.
Crazy.
Like crazy stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the people with like legendary record collections is from that time.
Yeah.
Like if it's hard to catch up. Like it would be hard for somebody now to catch up
do
with
that. You
with
can't
y'all.
Do that. Yeah. It's like, it's not fair, but it's also not, you don't need this problem anyway. it's a problem, you know.
Yeah,
you've seen it grow over the years, you know.
Yeah,
and everybody you know that does this is like has a part of like, oh man, why am I still doing this?
Did you ever listen to Marc Maron on Ice Cube on Marc Maron?
No, I didn't.
He talks about that.
Ice Cube?
Yeah.
He has
Marc
a record.
Maron.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because I know Marc Maron has a crazy record collection.
Yeah, because Maron, like, once he starts talking to Ice Cube, he's like, yeah, man. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, but he's like, yeah, I got a copy of a pulled out copy. I got the vinyl, man, from America's Most Wanted. Oh, sounds freaking awesome, man.
Yeah.
And Cube is like, yeah. And he's like, but Marc Maron says something really hilarious. Like, yeah. You know, like every other middle-aged douchebag, I got all these records. But yeah.
Yeah.
But like it's a thing. And I mean, it's the thing that connects it to historical music. Mm-hmm. Like it connects it to the history of music.
Yeah.
And I always remember you saying, like, something's not real until it's on vinyl.
Yeah.
And the first time that I like held vinyl in my hand, it was like
with your name on
Shadows
it.
On the Sun vinyl. It's like, yo,
yes,
like this is part of these like big record libraries.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're actually, it's part, you're part of music now.
Yeah, that's how I always felt. And it's funny because when we started making records, they weren't making records anymore, really. Right. You know, some certain, just a few things, obviously. Hip-hop was still doing it, pressing, but it wasn't like it used to be.
Yeah.
And then we'd press our own.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and when I first saw my name on the record, on that Beyond Comparison record, man, one of the happiest days of my life.
Yeah,
now I've done it 100 times, and I still, there's that one day. It's never like that. It's just like any drug, you know what I mean. I just look at it, and go,
yeah,
still chasing it. You know, I'm still chasing that high.
Me too. Yeah.
So I'm glad vinyl's back, by the way. I'm so glad because it's such a big part of my life, you know.
It makes a lot of sense. We talk about therapy almost every week on this show because you hear a conversation with somebody like Ant. The people that have been through therapy are ready to talk. They know how to do it. Me and BK, the producer of the podcast, we talk about this all the time. Guests that have been in therapy, it's like, this is going to be a dope episode because they're ready to go. You know what I'm saying? So it's really beautiful. This is the season of life when we have the opportunity and really the responsibility to sit with ourselves and to really find out what's going on in there and to give ourselves the time and the opportunity to just explore it. Therapy is not like it looks in the movies where you sit and lay on the couch and they tell you all this stuff about yourself. It's really an opportunity for us to talk through all of these experiences we've had and the thoughts and meanings and narratives that we've formed around this stuff. And every week I talk about different reasons to do it. I hope this one doesn't feel too heavy. But if you haven't done therapy, think about doing it for your kids. Think about the fact that a lot of what's going on with us, a lot of the areas where we're broken or incomplete or in need of healing and attention, a lot of that stuff came from our parents. And very few of our parents are sociopaths that just want to abuse their children and neglect their children and scar them for life. But they had stuff going on inside of them that they didn't get to address, they didn't get to heal. And so they were doing their best, but they say hurt people hurt people. And it doesn't always have to be that way. Sometimes hurt people heal people. Sometimes hurt people learn about their hurt and they don't have to repeat those cycles. But it's really important for us, for our own sake and also for the sake of the people that we love, to take some time to talk through it with a therapist. BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/travelers is the website that you can go to. You know, I need therapy like everybody else. I think we should all be in therapy. That's just what I believe. And the people that I know that have never done therapy, it's like, man, I hope you get on board. They all know how I feel and they keep ignoring it. And I keep on like, man, you just can't make somebody else do it. People are going to do it when they're ready. But go to betterhelp.com/travelers. That's what I do because I don't have a job and I don't live in America. So if you've got barriers to mental health and mental health services, this is a great way to do it. But it'll take you to a questionnaire. You're completely in the driver's seat. You tell them what you're looking for. You decide, you pick your own therapist. You choose how you're going to meet and connect with each other. And then you start doing it on your own terms. If you ever want to change your therapist, you just change them. You know what I'm saying? Make sure you find somebody you vibe with. Make sure you find somebody that you feel like this is somebody that's going to be able to accompany me and help guide me along this journey of me discovering myself. They're not going to give me the answers. They're going to help me find my own answers. That's what great therapists do. So if you go to betterhelp.com/travelers, you'll get a discount. We also get a commission to help the work that we do here. And it's a win-win for everybody. So like you were on probation. I don't think people realize that even the time, like the whole time that you guys were touring.
Yeah.
So like something you did when you were 18, 19 years old, follow you till you're in your 40s.
Well, yeah, because I was on probation for 20 years.
Crazy.
Yeah. And I had to go see my probation officer once a month. And as after 10-year mark, I think it went down to every quarterly, like taxes, like or something. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I was in there and slowly paying on the fine, because I just pay $100 a month or something, or whatever I could afford. And back in the early 90s, I couldn't afford shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when I first moved to Minnesota in 1990, and all the crimes happened in Colorado. I did all that then. And it was like, I need to move. When my mom lived here, and I lived in Colorado with my dad, my mom was like, hey, why don't you come to Minnesota, get a fresh start? They have a music scene here. You know, everybody just says that because of Prince and shit, right? Yeah. But it's like, that's the furthest thing from what I'm going to be doing. Right. But whatever. I love Prince and I love Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, my favorite producers of all time. Mm. So I'm like, okay. That's something, you know what I mean? Maybe I'll go there. Because it was either that or like New York, you know what I mean? In 1990 when I'm 21 or 20, I'm like, come on now. So I was like, I'll come here and see how it goes, you know? And that's when I left all that crime stuff. I never looked back. Mm. Probation officer there was like, yeah, it'd be good if you left Colorado. So I'll let you leave.
Because sometimes
they can like, tell
yeah,
you to stay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I've known people that have had that exact conversation.
Oh, yeah. And they won't
like,
let
I
want to
change my life. And they're just like, nah, you're going to disappear.
I think they believe me. I think they believe that I was trying to be right. You know what I mean? Because I tried to make a deal, too. Because I was like, man, what if I just tell them, just send me in the military. Just send me in the army. Mm. And, you know, because I used to hear about that used to happen to people in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they were like, shit, we don't need no one in the military. This is the 80s. We run this place. Yeah. You know, we don't need people.
Right.
And so they didn't. And my dad was like, man, military ain't for you. I don't know what's for you, but it ain't this. I remember him telling me that. You know what I mean? Like, pretty, like when he didn't say a lot of real shit too often, but when he did, well, it was, you felt it in your spirit. You know what I mean? You felt that. He was, and I was like, yeah.
Like your personality is just not going to.
There's something about me that's not built for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, or maybe he saw something bigger for me. I don't know. Mm. Not that there's anything wrong with anybody's choices, but he just, that was like one of his only things he ever directed me away from that.
So coming to Minnesota was like, this is my new lease on life.
Yeah, I'm going to start over here.
Yeah.
And then when I came, but my thing was like, I was like, even the hell with music for a minute. I was just like, I just need to catch my breath. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I was really in bad shape. I was really in bad shape. And I just needed to refocus. And, you know, everybody, you know, and that's when I start introducing myself as Anthony, which is my name. But back in the day, it was Tony. Everybody called me Tony. And so that even that was like a symbolic kind of, I'm going to change. I'm going to be a different person.
Yeah.
I'm going to be, you know, responsible and all this stuff. And I did. I got a couple square jobs, you know, worked at some restaurants for a few years.
You used to like clean the...
Yeah. Oh, the vents.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to clean vents. Used to climb up in vents and use chemicals on roofs and scrape scrape hoods and
the fryer fat.
The fat. Scrape that shit out. And I even got a hole in my foot to this day from that damn chemical. Mm. Not a hole, but it sounds fun saying it.
Yeah.
It's like a little scar. But them chemicals that eat fat.
That's the worst job you had?
That's the worst job I had, yeah. Yeah. But it paid like a motherfucker, man. Until this rap shit.
My brother was a window washer before he got with his wife now.
Really?
Because he's fearless. Like he has
really?
Yeah. He used to like race motorcycles and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And like he would always win these races because like he would turn too close to people. Like he, I don't know. Yeah. Like I think he's good. I think he's a good driver.
Yeah.
But he was just so fearless that like he would like turn in front of people and it'd be like, yo. So he could win it. Yeah. He was like doing the like window washer thing because he just.
Dude. That's tight.
If you do those horrible jobs, nobody wants.
Yeah, nobody wants them horrible jobs. Yeah, those guys are a trip. I'm scared of heights, kind of. So it's like, no way I could do that. Okay. But I've heard about those guys getting paid good and stuff.
So one of the things that me and you bonded over is like when we were really young.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird, man. For as much as like our dads are like huge in our life, but it's also, like I'm still. We talked about this yesterday, but like, I still am like, I would like for my dad to, I wish I could tell him something that would make him happy about me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For like, as much as I was trying to get away from him, I always wanted to, you know, feel good or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then also, we both really young, we're trying to do like family life.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So like you got married.
I got married real young, yeah, like 22. Like, step kids, yep.
But you were like raising. You've been raising children ever since I met you.
Yeah, and you know it was crazy about that too. I had no business being. I mean, come on, I'm a complete knucklehead, moron. I talk insane, you know. At
you
that time,
crazy.
I talk a little crazy
you
back
talk
then.
Crazy. Yeah.
I shouldn't have been around no kids, man. Mm. But that's the mama's fault. Just kidding. Sorry, peace. In case you see this, you all right. But I was around those guys and mm-hmm. I did some good and I did some regrettable words too. Mm. I was a monster at times too because my dad was who he was and I was like, man, I'm better than him. But that's not enough. You know what I mean? That's not enough. And I didn't know that until my 20s. And then when I got out of that relationship, in my 30s, I got into another one just like it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been like, you know, like one of Slug's lines and one codependent to the next. You know what I mean? Like just kept it moving, you know. But the stability of family was wonderful for me in another way. Mm-hmm. So in my 20s, when everybody else is out doing 20-year-old shit, I'm trying to raise a family. I'm trying to keep a job and trying to advance in my job. All while have this music dream because I quit for like 6 months, but that came back with a vengeance and I was back into music and I'm trying to make music with this going on. But my relationships I was in, those women liked that I would just stay in the basement all the night. They loved it. I just went to work and then went home and just worked on music. You know what I mean? Yeah. They would get jealous here and there of time, but
of just like the amount of time
that
and how much you care about it.
All that stuff. So I had to deal with some of that. But, you know, just the stability of that life created my music to be what it is.
Because there's only one period since I've known you that you didn't have like basically what we're at now, which is like basement full of music things.
Yeah.
You making music from 10 p.m. till 6 a.m.
Yeah.
But there's like there's a woman and some kids walking around upstairs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That they just live with like boom, boom, pff, through the floor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All night.
Dude.
Like that's always been you.
Yeah, always been me. I've always been, it's funny because like this is the third time around, but you know, I have kids now and my 5-year-old, I asked him one night, I was like, hey man, do you hear my music at night? Does it bother you? He goes, no, I just hear beats. I was like, oh my G.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just meant like you just hear the thumps.
Yeah, what he said the other day, this is the jam, right?
Yeah. Goes, hey dad, that's the jam, right? I was like, yeah.
No.
Yeah, buddy. That's the jam.
Yeah, man.
Kids are cool.
So okay, so the period in the 90s, like when you get here, you start doing the music thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then then you put a, then you put like, people have no idea about this now.
Okay.
But like the idea of putting a sign up in a store with like little things that you can rip off.
Yeah,
you, you did that, right?
I did that, yeah. And I made a, so we're talking, you know, it's 93, 94. Cause I actually remember 93 cause of 93 Till Infinity. That stuff was out. Mm. And it was funny because I, you know, I wasn't real big on that, but I liked it. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that and I was like, I can make stuff like that. I started being inspired by the guys that were coming out in the early 90s. Because prior to that, my biggest, one of my biggest heroes was Dr. Dre. And he just seemed impossible.
That's untouchable.
Seemed, I can't even imagine. And Molly Mall, like, it can't be done from what I, from my view, my vantage point.
Yeah.
Time moves on a little bit, and then it started being like, I started getting a little better, and other people started being like me. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe there is a shot here after all.
Mm.
Long story short, I started making flyers because I don't have any friends here. I didn't grow up here. And when you're in your early 20s, it's different to make friends. It's different than when you're in school.
Right.
And everybody I knew was through my ex-wife's family.
Mm.
So it was like old dudes that got rejected by the Prince community. Yeah. They could sing and stuff, but they just, whatever, you know what I mean? They were good and talented. They just couldn't make it in the Prince world, you know what I mean? Because that's all there was here.
Yeah.
And there was lots of those dudes.
Yes.
And those dudes, I used to work with those guys, but they wanted to sing and they wanted changes and they want, I'm giving you a breakbeat, fool. You better sing on this like some, you know.
You're supposed to say, I'm here to please. I'll give you what you need.
Unselfish love. Yeah, let's do that joint.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no.
Oh,
no,
Crash
no.
Crew, man. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they're not into that. So I had all that, and I had a couple rap guys here and there, but no one that ever took anything serious.
Mm.
So I hadn't had anybody serious since the 80s. When I was in the 80s, I had five or six rap dudes I worked with.
But those dudes were serious.
They were serious. They all wrote. They wrote their rhymes. Like, they would write the rhymes like, my main dude, Frosty, dope MC. He would write that the last word was the rhyme word.
Uh-huh.
And so the next, that was one bar. The second bar, even though none of us knew what bars were.
Right.
His second line on the paper, wherever that ended, that's the end of the bar.
Okay.
That word and that word rhyme. Those words rhyme. If they don't rhyme, you're off beat.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's the snare on there, you know? Mm-hmm. So he just wrote his raps like that. And that's how I learned, you know, like, oh, if I release the Friends beat, pow. And then I would see where his rhymes land, and then I would know when his last line, I was like, oh, it seems to always land on these rap beats at the same spot these other guys, you know what I mean? Like, there's a switch or something. So that's way out of the way, but you know, that's
no,
how you
I'm
learn
saying, but
that's
yeah
how you
like
learn.
You have to figure it out. There's not language
out.
For it.
Yeah,
there's no like, yeah, especially if you don't come from
music.
Like if your music background is just listening to records and then listening to rap music.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure out bars
trying to figure stuff
and structure
out.
And
just,
all that stuff.
They come from you sharing information with one another, but then there's also the people hiding information. That was a big thing.
Oh, hell yeah. In hip hop, people are haters, man.
Dude. That's,
people, because the big thing is like, having the drop on other people
is part of it.
It's crazy how that's always been a thing in hip hop.
Yeah, it's wild.
Like, I was just thinking about even like when the blogs were like doing their thing, like their thing is like they were always trying to angle to be the first person to have the leaked whatever. So there's like certain blogs that you would go to.
Yeah.
All of the DJs were like that.
Yeah.
You hear about like Bambaataa and Kool Herc and them like scratching the labels off their records so other DJs wouldn't know what beat that was.
Yeah. I mean, I did my versions too, you know what I mean? I'm sure, you know, but it's a whole different kind of thing.
Cause now I think people can go like you can. Anything you want to do, you can look on YouTube and somebody would, their whole version of that is showing you.
And it's awesome. It's great. It's really sweet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That there's some things about this here future that's kind of cool, you know?
So you're like trying to find people in Minnesota that were
serious. Man, we'd be going off track a little. Sorry about that.
No, it's the, it's the best.
Yeah, so made these flyers and I was like, got to make some friends, but I'm kind of luring in people. They're thinking when they see these flyers, they think they can get a record deal.
Mm.
The one thing that's always
what
held
said? Like, what'd you write?
Studio, 4-track, looking for Or I think I was trying to make money on, that's what it was. I wasn't trying to make money, but my ex was like, well, why don't you make some money? You got that equipment down there. Right. Why don't you put out these flyers and charge people $50 an hour or something, like real studios. I didn't have a real studio, but she didn't know no difference.
Right.
But I was like, well, you know what, actually.
There's a lot of lights and knobs and levers and stuff down there. Get some money coming.
But I was like, well, actually though, I can make flyers and I can meet people that need my services. I can meet like-minded people. Mm-hmm. As far as she knew, is I was going to start charging people, so maybe it had some kind of money sign on the flyer that incentivized certain kinds of people to call me, and they would call and be like, "Yeah, hey, so what can I get for the record contract and stuff like that?" You know, one thing about people, they've just been dumb forever. You know what I mean? They're dumb now. They were dumb then. They were dumb in the '80s and '70s. They've always just been dumb. Mm. For the most part, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just people, just...
If you deal with the public, man, that's one of the main things that you learn is like the... Yeah.
9 times out of 10, man.
People just don't get... They don't understand what they're looking at.
Yeah. So it's unlike... God bless the people that have time to deal with that shit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I used to get calls, all these crazy calls, and every now and then it'd be like, you know... And I'd just tell, no, this is... This is a you pay me kind of situation, you know what I mean? And then I would usually get rid of people that way. But then I had a couple of people come by and would kind of rapping and, you know, doing their thing or, you know, whatever. And it just wouldn't click, or they wouldn't follow up or whatever. And then one time, Hazzy P, my man Harry Unicus, came by, and he was like, he had an interesting little voice, and he was young, man. He was like, if he's 17, 18, maybe. I'm 25, 26, or something like that.
Which is like a generation at that time.
Yeah, it's really different. Like 20, me and me, I might have been 24, actually. But either way, it seemed like lifetimes away. He was just getting out of high school, I think.
Yeah.
And I've been doing this whole fucking house thing and all this stuff. But and he's got a cool little voice, and we both vibe on the one thing we had in common was the Tribe Called Quest and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, great, like-minded people.
And he's Haitian.
Yeah, he's a Haitian cat. Yeah. Yep. So he has an interesting voice.
And he can sing. Yeah. He's one of the most like naturally talented people.
Yeah. He's very, and just a sweet guy.
Beautiful dude.
Yeah. And his crew was had Musab in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's
he was
Labyrinth.
Like, yeah, Labyrinth, yep. And there was another dude too, who was like more of a type of raps, you know what I mean? Like, fast and shit. So I was like, they came over.
Stethoscope elliptical.
Yeah, all that shit. Yeah. And could have swore he was the tightest rapper alive.
Of course, yeah.
Corny ass motherfucker. So they came over, and I was like, oh yeah. Yeah, these guys are fun. This is tight. Mm-hmm. And so... And I had a good eye on how Musab was. Mm. Like right off the bat, I was like, oh man, this dude's he's gifted. This is different.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started doing like little solo songs, and he was doing "It's a Wonderful Life to Live" when you da da da, like this mundane but happy, sad, just all this stuff. And we were able to just talk about stuff. You know what I mean? You know how he is.
Yeah. Like,
I don't know. I've seen him on the podcast, and I don't know if that conveyed really well, but he can go there, you know?
He's one of the most dynamic people.
Yeah, he's got all the stories. He's got all the life. Even then, when I met him, he was 18 years old. He already had a hella story.
Yeah.
Crazy story. Beautiful stuff. And just a beautiful dude. And so
I think he's only 2 years older than me, but he's always felt.
Yeah.
So like, you and Sean and Sadiq always felt a full generation older than me. Like, because when I met you guys, I was 20, 19. I wasn't old enough to drink. I know that.
And I keep forgetting about that too, that you were that young when I met you.
Yeah, I was 19, 20.
I always forget that.
I met you at 19. I met Sadiq at 20.
Because you were always like a big dude. You know what I mean? I was like, that ain't no kid.
Trying to be grown and all that.
Yeah.
But also I was like sober, and I was like a minister at a mosque and like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's funny because you guys were always like very clearly a full generation older than me. And it's even hard for me to not be like that.
See it that way. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But Musav was only like 2 years older than me and still felt like he felt like an older guy to me.
Yeah.
Because of...
He had a lot of experiences, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. And then when me and him just started making lots of songs and lots of different kinds of ways too. We went through a lot of different phases of making styles of stuff. And then, you know, it just led into all this whole world, you know, meeting those guys in Pacific. I just met this whole city through them guys.
Yeah.
And Saab in specific, you know.
So yeah.
Just met this whole city that way.
Special thanks to my man Ant for being so generous and gracious with his time and his wisdom and just with himself. This is the first of two episodes. The next one coming up is really incredible. Now that we've talked a lot about his personal background, in the next episode, we really dive into the musical career and how that came together and evolved. And it's a really incredible story. And we're just very, very grateful to him. We're grateful to you for being here. Make sure to check out BetterHelp. Make sure to go to brotherali.com and get in the join section. Make sure to check out Zakat Foundation at zakat.org or zakatus on social media. All of this stuff is really beautiful. Special thanks to Emna Mirza, to Mansoor Panawala, to Darian Washington, to Last Word, to all the people that listen to this podcast and give me feedback. You're all part of it. Imam Khalis Rashad. Shout out to everybody in the top tier of the caravan. You know what I'm saying? All people that really helped this thing come together. Travelers Podcast is produced by Brennan Kelly, a.k.a. BK1. We got two episodes with BK1. A few weeks back, go back and check those out. Really beautiful, dope stuff. And it's a product of Travelers Media. We'll see you here next week. We love you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.